Hello, and welcome to Learning English on the Voice of America. I'm Katie Weaver. On today's show, Ashley Thompson and I visit a U.S. national park in Arkansas, believed by many to have healing powers. We also hear a report from Christopher Jones Cruise about an unusual bookstore in the American state of Virginia. And we complete the program with another classic short story by an American writer. Today we listen to part one of The Bride Comes to Yellow Sky by Stephen Crane. The story, published in 1898, is set in Texas, and it is a true Western, complete with a gunfighter, a lawman, and a busy saloon. But first, U.S. President Barack Obama spoke in New York this week at a U.S.-Africa business gathering. The central message of his speech was clear and simple. Africa wants trade, not aid. Here is Marcia James with more on the story.
There may be conflicts, poverty, and disease in Africa. But the President of the United States says the direction of the continent is unmistakable. President Barack Obama told business leaders this week that Africa is on the move. He spoke at a meeting of the U.S.-Africa Business Forum in New York City. Obama said the African continent is home to some of the fastest growing economies in the world and powered by the youngest population anywhere on the planet. Africa has a middle class projected to grow to more than a billion customers, he added. Obama told the meeting that everywhere he travels in Africa, from Senegal to South Africa, Africans insist they do not just want aid. They want trade. They want partners, not patrons. To help American businesses and investment, the U.S. government has become more active in Africa. Since 2008, the Department of Commerce has opened offices in Angola, Ethiopia, Mozambique, and Tanzania. The department also has an expanded presence in Ghana and re-established a presence at the African Development Bank. Two well-known Americans led the U.S.-Africa Business Forum meeting: Commerce Secretary Penny Pritzker and former New York City Mayor Michael Bloomberg. The event was designed to help investors and business people from Africa and North America get acquainted with each other. As Obama explained, all of you should be wanting to make money and create great products and great services, and be profitable and do right by your investors. But the good news is, in Africa right now, if you are doing well, you can also be doing a lot of good. One of the young people he spoke about is Frances Uduku from Nigeria. She is currently serving as Miss Africa USA. Frances Uduku is only 26 years old, but she recently launched a nonprofit organization called the Lead Girl Foundation. Its goal is to help girls and young women make a life for themselves through business and occupational training. She said, "My personal favorite thing is being able to touch the lives of many young girls and women across not only Africa, but in the United States as well." Uduku lives in Washington, D.C., but travels to Nigeria often. She attended Temple University in Philadelphia and studied public health. She plans to go to law school. I'm Marcia James.
A large bookstore in a small U.S. town has succeeded for many years by giving people a chance to buy a lot of books for a low price. The large and simple bookstore is in the small eastern town of Mount Crawford, Virginia. The Green Valley Book Fair is made up of two large storage buildings totaling 2,300 square meters. Some customers, like Zoe Dellinger, have been buying books at the store for many years.
I've been coming since I was in my early 20s. The thrill of finding a new book is very serendipitous here, because you can't come and say, "I'm buying the new Nicholas Sparks book today." That's not what this place is about. This place is about finding wonderful treasures.
And those treasures are not costly.
I found a wonderful book that I wanted. It was very expensive at the time. $25, $26 was expensive for me to purchase a new book. I found the book here for $5. I was so excited. So that has kept me coming back just to see what treasure I'll find.
The Green Valley Book Fair has 500,000 new and old books about politics, religion, science, travel, cooking, and many other subjects. Michelle Branner is the manager of the store.
My parents actually started this bookstore about 46 years ago. My dad collected old books and then decided that he wanted to sell some of them. And it went so well, it just kind of evolved to what it is today.
The bookstore is only open six times a year for 3 weeks. About 25,000 people visit during each period. The store sells about $2 million worth of books every year.
We buy our books at a fraction of retail, and we can sell them for the prices that we do and keep our overhead low. That's why we don't have any fancy buildings or anything like that.
People have visited the store from many American states, and from Kenya, Saudi Arabia, Turkey, and Russia. Tom Witten is from the eastern city of Bristol, Connecticut.
We have our whole family with us this time, so we said, "Oh, you got to see this book fair," and so we brought them all here today. It meets every family's need that likes to read.
I'm Christopher Jones Cruz.
Sometimes a visit to a national park means hiking rugged trails and climbing high mountains. Other times, it means crawling through caves or rafting down a wild river. But this week, we want to take it easier. So, we head south to the state of Arkansas. It is home to a national park that is perfect for resting and renewing a tired body. Visitors treat themselves to one of its natural thermal baths. Humans have been enjoying the warm waters for thousands of years. Welcome to Hot Springs National Park.
Most national parks are far from cities and industry, but Hot Springs is different. It covers more than 2,200 hectares in and around the city of Hot Springs, Arkansas. Congress approved special protection of the area in 1832. Known unofficially as America's Spa, it became a national park in 1921. The park's geothermal springs and other resources have long been used for therapeutic bathing. The average temperature of the hot springs is 61 degrees Celsius. The thermal mineral waters reportedly help ease many health problems, including arthritis and rheumatism. The springs emerge along the western edge of Hot Springs Mountain. Scientists say the hot springs are made of rainwater that fell in the hot springs area thousands of years ago. The rainwater slowly dripped down to the Earth's crust. When water rises back up to the surface quickly and does not have a chance to cool, hot springs form.
Hot Springs National Park's early bathhouses were simple structures. They were made of canvas and lumber. They were built right over some of the natural springs. Later, businessmen built more complex wooden structures, but those structures were frequently damaged by fires and from exposure to water and steam. Beginning in the early 1900s, stone, stucco, and brick structures replaced the wooden bathhouse buildings. These large and much more elaborate structures still stand today along what is known as Bathhouse Row. These bathhouses were built along the eastern bank of Hot Springs Creek. The hot water from the hillside springs flows down a system of wooden troughs and into the buildings.
Each spring was said to help cure different kinds of conditions. Some of the early names referred to their chemical properties. Others were named after the part of the body that its waters could best help. There was once a spring called kidney, and another named liver. 8 buildings line Bathhouse Row today. They are very large. Many of them are 3 levels. But most of them no longer offer therapeutic water treatments. Instead, they house park shops and the visitor center. But one has remained open for more than 100 years. The Buckstaff Bathhouse has operated continuously since 1912. It is one of the best-preserved bathhouses within Hot Springs National Park. Visitors today can enjoy traditional thermal mineral baths. The baths are different temperatures and have different properties.
Another bathhouse offers a more modern spa experience. Quapa Baths and Spa also sits along Bathhouse Row. It was renovated and reopened in 2007 on Hot Springs' 175th anniversary. When you are done with your relaxing bath, there is still more to enjoy at Hot Springs National Park. Visitors can hike along the more than 43 kilometers of trails in the park. You will find unusual rock formations and views of the surrounding rolling hills. The landscape provides evidence of the area's hot spring history. On the Tufa Terrace Trail, you will see huge deposits of tufa created by the flowing springs over thousands of years. Tufa is a kind of rock shaped by water.
But you do not have to hike to see the sights. There are beautiful mountain roads to drive as well. However you explore Hot Springs National Park, you can't help but relax.
From VOA Learning English, this is American Stories. Our story is called The Bride Comes to Yellow Sky. It was written by Stephen Crane. We will listen to the story in two parts. Today, we will hear the first part of the story.
The Bride Comes to Yellow Sky. The great train was rushing forward. Such steady dignity of motion that a glance from the window seemed to simply prove that the flatlands of Texas were pouring toward the east. A newly married pair had come on this train at San Antonio. The man's face was reddened from many days in the wind and sun. His roughened hands were continually moving over his new black clothes in a most nervous manner. From time to time, he looked down respectfully at his suit. He sat with a hand on each knee, like a man waiting in a shop for a haircut. The glances he gave to other passengers were few and quick. The bride was not pretty, nor was she very young. She wore a dress of blue with many buttons. She continually turned her head to regard some part or other of her dress. It made her feel strange. One could tell that she had cooked and that she expected to cook dutifully. The searching glances of some of the passengers as she had entered the car had brought the blood rushing to her face. Her uncomfortable expression was strange to see upon this plain face, which was usually calm and almost emotionless. They were evidently very happy.
"Ever been in a train like this before?"
he asked, smiling with delight.
"No," she answered. "I never was. It's fine, isn't it?"
"Great. After a while, we'll go forward to the dining car and get a big dinner. Finest meal in the world. Costs a dollar."
"Oh, it does?" cried the bride. "A dollar? Oh, that's too much for us, isn't it, Jack?"
"Not on this trip, at least," he answered bravely. "We're going to enjoy ourselves."
Later, he explained to her about the trains.
"You see, it's 1,000 miles from one end of Texas to the other. The train runs straight across it and only stops 4 times. He had the pride of an owner.
He pointed out to her the beauty of the car they were riding in. And in truth, her eyes opened wider as she observed the rich sea-green cloth covering the seats, the shining silver and glass, the wood that shone darkly like the surface of a pool of oil. To the minds of the pair, their surroundings repeated the glory of their wedding that morning in San Antonio. This was the spirit of their new life, and the man's face in particular shone with a joy that made him appear foolish to certain passengers. In the minds of some, there was supposed to be something hugely funny in the pair's situation. "We're due in Yellow Sky at 3:42, he said, looking tenderly into her eyes.
"Oh, are we?"
she said, as if she had not been aware of it. To show surprise at her husband's remark was part of her wifely duty. She took from her pocket a little silver watch. As she held it before her and stared at it with a look of attention, the new husband's face shone. "I bought it in San Antonio from a friend of mine," he told her proudly.
"It's 12:17,
she said, looking up at him with a happy expression which, nevertheless, showed a lack of experience in conversing with men. A passenger, observing her small nervousness, laughed to himself. At last they went to the dining car. The man serving their table happened to take pleasure in directing them through their meal. He viewed them with the manner of a fatherly guide, his face shining with kindness. But they did not understand his attentions. As they returned to their seats, they showed in their faces a sense of escape. It was evident that, as the distance from Yellow Sky grew shorter, the husband became more nervous. His red hands were even more noticeable. He was rather absent-minded and far away when the bride leaned forward and spoke to him. As a matter of truth, Jack Potter was beginning to find his deed weighing upon him like a great stone. He, the town policeman of Yellow Sky, was a man known, liked, and feared in his community. He, an important person, had gone to San Antonio to meet a girl he believed he loved, and there he had actually married her without discussing any part of the matter with Yellow Sky. He was now bringing his bride to a sure-to-be-surprised town. Of course, people in Yellow Sky married as it pleased them, but Potter's thoughts of his duty to his friends, or of their idea of his duty, made him feel he was sinful. He was guilty of a great and unusual crime. Face to face with this girl in San Antonio, he had leaped all over the social fences. At San Antonio, he was like a man hidden in the dark. A knife to cut any friendly duty was easy to take in his hand in that distant city. But the hour of Yellow Sky, the hour of daylight, was approaching. He knew very well that his wedding was an important thing to the town. It could only be equaled by the burning of the new hotel. His friends could not forgive him, he felt. And now the train was hurrying him toward a scene of surprise, merriment, and blame. He glanced out of the window again. Yellow Sky had a kind of band which played its horns and drums painfully to the delight of the people. He laughed without heart as he thought of it. If the citizens could dream of his arrival with his bride, they would march the band at the station and accompany them among cheers and laughter to his house. He decided that he would use all methods of speed and cleverness in making the journey from the station to his house. Once safely at home, he would announce the news. Then he would not go among the citizens until they had had time to master their emotions. The bride looked anxiously at him.
"What's worrying you, Jack?"
He laughed. "I'm not worrying, girl. I'm only thinking of Yellow Sky." She understood, and her face turned red again. They shared a sense of slight guilt that developed a finer tenderness. They looked at each other with eyes softly glowing. But Potter often laughed the same nervous laugh. The deep red color upon the bride's face did not lessen.
"We're nearly there," he said.
As the train began to slow, they moved forward in the car. The long line of cars moved into the station of Yellow Sky.
"The train has to get water here," said Potter from a tight throat and face, as one announcing death. Before the train stopped, his eye had searched the station, and he was glad and surprised to see there was no one there except the station master.
"Come on, girl," said Potter with a thick voice. As he helped her down, they each laughed in a strained manner. He took her bag and told his wife to hold his arm. As they hurried away, he saw that the station master had turned and was running toward them, waving his arms. Potter laughed, and sighed as he laughed when he realized the first effect of his wedding upon Yellow Sky. He grasped his wife's arm firmly to his side, and they hurried away. The California train was due at Yellow Sky in 21 minutes. There were 6 men in the Weary Gentleman's saloon. One was a salesman who talked a great deal and rapidly. 3 were Texans who did not care to talk at that time, and 2 were Mexican sheep farmers who did not usually talk in the saloon. The saloon keeper's dog lay in front of the door. His head was resting on his feet, and he glanced sleepily here and there with the ready watchfulness of a dog that is sometimes kicked. Across the sandy street were some bright green grass spots, so wonderful in appearance next to the burning sands in the hot sun. At the cooler side of the railroad station, a man without a coat sat in a chair leaned back against the building. He smoked his pipe. The waters of the Rio Grande River circled near the town, and beyond it could be seen great flatlands. Except for the busy salesman and his companions in the saloon, Yellow Sky was sleeping. The salesman leaned easily upon a table and told many tales with the confidence of a storyteller who's found new listeners. He was interrupted by a young man who suddenly appeared in the open door. He cried, "Scratchy Wilson's drunk, and he has started to make trouble." The 2 Mexicans at once put down the glasses and disappeared through the rear door of the saloon. The salesman, not understanding the importance of the warning, jokingly answered, "All right, old man, suppose he has. Come in and have a drink anyhow." But the information had made such an apparent impression upon everyone in the room that the salesman was forced to see its importance. All had become instantly serious. "Well," he said, filled with mystery, "what is this?" His 3 companions started to tell him, but the young man at the door stopped them. "It means, my friend," he answered as he came into the saloon, "that for the next 2 hours this town won't be very healthy." The saloon keeper went to the door and locked it. Reaching out of the window, he pulled in heavy wooden boards which covered the windows and locked there. The salesman was looking from one to another. "What is this, anyhow?" he cried. "You don't mean it's going to be a gunfight?"
Come back to American Stories next week for the second half of The Bride Comes to Yellow Sky by Stephen Crane.
I'm Katie Weaver. That's all the time we have for today. But we will be back tomorrow with another Learning English program from the Voice of America. Thanks for joining us.